in a bit of time here. Do we have someone that will lead us in a verse or in a song? In one song, I think to start with. Julian, will you do that? Okay. Well, welcome to each one, and welcome especially to Mike and Arlen and Kevin, who are here this evening to talk to us about estate planning. When Pete Fleming called me and wondered if I would be willing to share it in an opening, I said I would, and he said he'd like to have me speak on the biblical basis for estate planning. And I see you chuckling a little bit because you probably wonder, what am I going to say now? But the first thing I thought of, and foundational to all of stewardship, is our concept of ownership. Who really owns the things we have? And who are we responsible to? And I had to think almost immediately of the parable of the talents found in Matthew 25. I'd like to read just a part of that parable, verses 14 through 19. I'm going to read, it's a very familiar parable, and yet we ought to be instructed by it frequently, because it does remind us of who we are, whose we are, and whose our things are. It says, "For the kingdom of heaven is as a man traveling into a far country, who called his own servants and delivered unto them his goods. And unto one he gave 5 talents, and to another 2, and to another 1. To every man according to his several ability, and straightway took his journey. Then he that had received 5 talents went and traded with the same, and made them 5 other talents. And likewise he that had received 2 also gained other 2. But he that had received 1 went and digged in the earth, and hid his Lord's money. After a long time, the Lord of those servants cometh and reckoneth with them." That's as far as I'm going to read for now. Well, the thing that this illustrates to us, first of all, is that if we would have read the rest of the passage, it would illustrate it perhaps even better. But it illustrates to us that, number one, these things belong to God, who is the king, or the, I guess in this case he says, the man who traveled and gave his servants each a certain amount of, he calls it talents. I think money is what we believe it is. We often broaden it to include other things that God gives us, abilities and gifts and so forth, but here he speaks specifically of money. And so he had, each of these 3 men received of their master, and it was up to them to do something with it. Now, apparently they all 3 assumed that there would be an accounting someday, because all 3 of them did something with it. And I don't know what motivated the 2 who were responsible in a way that the one who wasn't responsible didn't seem to be motivated. But there was a difference in the way that those men responded. Well, we notice that after a time, the man returned and was asking for an accounting. And that is another one of the concepts, one of the principles, I think, of stewardship in general, but also of it applies to estate planning. There's another concept that you may feel like it's a little bit of a stretch, but it's found in Matthew 22, verse 20. I'll just relate it to you for the sake of time. You remember that the the scribes and the Pharisees, it was, came to Jesus and they asked him, do we give to Caesar? Is it lawful for us to give to Caesar? Quite simply. And they, of course, expected they'd fixed a trap for him to walk into. And Jesus' response was, you give to Caesar the things that are Caesar's, and to God the things that are God's. Now you may wonder how I managed to work that into estate planning. One of the things that I think we'll hear about tonight, or learn, is that there are appropriate ways. Caesar does expect a certain amount of an estate, but there are ways that we can unnecessarily end up giving to Caesar. I think it's important. I think it's wise for us as Christians to be thoughtful and responsible with the way that we handle our estate planning for those reasons as well. The third thing that I'd mention is a scripture that can almost sound like it competes. And that is in Matthew 6:19, where we're rather pointedly instructed not to lay up for ourselves treasures on this earth, where moth and rust do their work, but to lay them up in heaven. And it occurs to me that there are, again, right ways and wrong ways to plan estates. And I know of elderly men, of people who left money for their family, but also left a large share of money that was to go to the Lord's work in one way or another. It's another way that you can be responsible in planning an estate. And so the whole concept is this, that we keep the eternal perspective on whatever we do and however we do it. Because of one primary thing that brings us back to the question of who actually owns what we have. And that is who we will give an account to when the time is over. It occurred to me this afternoon as I was mulling these things over that we are blessed in this country in ways that many are not. And I wonder if maybe these men here this evening could tell me what percent of the world needs to do estate planning. It occurred to me that maybe I ought to be instructed by that too. And so I'm eager to hear what these men have to share. And I trust that as we listen and as we learn, we can understand how better to be responsible with the things that we have that God has blessed us with. Let's bow our heads for prayer. Lord, you are a gracious God. And we have enjoyed your gracious hand in this country in ways that many people have not. And because of that, you ask us to be responsible stewards. Thank you for bringing these men to us this evening. Pray that you would bless each one of them and their part, that you would help us to understand your concepts, your ideas, and your ways of being responsible with the blessings that we have reaped. Guide us, and may this service honor you and edify each other. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen. Well, I don't think that any of these three men are strangers to us. Mike and Arlen spent some of their growing up years here in these pews. I mean, not these, but some about where these sat. And Kevin has been a familiar face here too, and so we welcome you. I'll turn the time over to Mike and let him take it from here.
Well, it's good to be here with you tonight, and I was recalling some years ago when I sat on these front pews. And I was thinking about what I might have thought about a Wednesday evening program on estate planning. And maybe my thoughts were similar to yours. This can't be very interesting, talking about what we do with our accumulated things and how this relates to a life of Christian stewardship. And it's kind of strange that here, after all these years, this is the kind of work that I'm involved with every day, and I find it completely fascinating. I guess that tells you something about my abnormality. So, I think it might be helpful for us here tonight just to talk a little bit, just before we get into this discussion, talk a little bit about the distinctive roles that the three of us have. And I'm going to take some liberties here, and I'm going to describe the work that Kevin and Arlen do here. And they can correct me once they get up here. Kevin, some of you know, because he does a lot of work with individuals in developing retirement strategies, helping families to plan. Often it's growing families, it's younger families. Arlen has a very specific skill because he's an attorney with a primary focus on estate planning and business planning, often trying to help families find orderly ways to have transitions of their family businesses and also to plan their estates. My role is a little different. I work for the Mennonite Foundation, an organization that has been around now for about 70 years. And it was started right after World War II. And I see a lot of, a group of you gentlemen here who came back from CPS camp. And it was a time of idealism. It was a time of recognizing that we as a church have a responsibility to steward the wealth we have in this country and to be careful planners and stewards of all that we have. And so in the 40s, the Mennonite Foundation was developed, came into being under the umbrella of Mennonite Mutual Aid, primarily to help people in their life of stewardship relating to their estates. And so what we're going to do here tonight, and by the way, we don't have an automatic advance here, so I'm going to have to show somebody here how to advance the PowerPoint. We don't have the most advanced technology here. One more. Our program here tonight, I'm going to make just a few opening remarks, setting the stage for the topic of estate planning. And then Arlen is going to talk about some of the basic tools that all of us need as we plan our estates, as we transition our estates, and as we plan for the various aspects of life, tools that we can use in case of disability to help manage and transfer assets. Kevin is going to talk about a couple of very specific estate management and protection tools that he gets involved with in his work. And then, if we have time, I'd like to talk just a little bit about how we can include charity as part of our estate planning. This is actually the core of much of my work with the Mennonite Foundation. And a big part of what we do is help people plan their estates to make gifts to charity. We want to be sure to allow plenty of time for question and answer, and then we'll conclude at that point. Okay, Arlen. One more. That, by the way, that last picture was a picture of the staff of Mennonite Mutual Aid on one of those rare sunny days in Goshen, Indiana. But we have a staff of about 300 people dedicated to the work of Mennonite Mutual Aid. Mennonite Mutual Aid exists solely for the purpose of helping Anabaptists and related groups, those with shared values, to practice a life of stewardship. And we have a whole variety of programs that some of you may be familiar with. Okay? One of the things that makes Mennonite Mutual Aid distinctive from other financial organizations is not only is it our tie to the church, but at the very center, we believe that our faith in Christ should have a very direct implication for how we live our lives, how we use our resources, and the lives we create together in our communities. There are several goals that we have as we work together. One, in the world of estate planning, one, we think it's important to think about some kind of proportionate giving out of our estates. It may or may not be appropriate for all of us. In some cases, I think it probably isn't appropriate, but we see a lot of people thinking at least about some kind of major gift out of their estate, and that's been very much an important part of the work of the Mennonite Foundation to support missions, Christian education, and those kinds of things. Another very important but frequently not talked about role that we have is in helping families to transition estates in a way that preserves wholeness and health in families. And I'm going to give an example of how that can work itself out in not such pleasant ways. Just last week, I was visiting with a family. And some years ago, the father had set up an estate plan where he was very explicitly trying to settle a score with a daughter with whom he'd had significant differences. And he was showing preferential treatment to two of his sons, with whom he was more compatible in many respects. And he came into our meeting last week, and he said, "What I've done is not right. It's not healthy for the family, and I want to take care of this in our next round of estate planning." And so he's working at equalizing things with the children, because in this case, there really isn't a good reason to have inequality within the family. And so, and part of my role in that kind of situation is to encourage actions that promote health and relationship. Well, Arlen, go ahead. Within the Christian community, there has been a shared consensus on what constitutes Christian stewardship. David touched on some of these, but it is at the heart of it, of course, is this sense that all that we have in our possession is in fact God's, and we're merely caretakers, and we are to use these for the sake of the kingdom. But Christians have generally agreed on these three points. One, that stewardship is the proper and generous use of our time, talents, and treasure. Stewardship is all that we do with our lives after reciting our baptismal promises. Stewardship is about joyfully returning to God a portion of that bounty which God has bestowed upon us. It's this whole idea of proportionate giving. And it's similar to what we do in the offering on a Sunday morning, but we're doing it out of our estates. We can view that as a last great act of Christian stewardship. Okay, Arm. I think I'm going to just skip over a couple of things here. Arlen, why don't you move on down? One more. A lot of the work I do involves family meetings. And in those meetings, we review documents, estate planning documents. I read an article here a few years ago that said, and this was in the Journal of Practical Estate Planning, said that 70% of us have no plan. This is, of course, dealing with national statistics. 21% have the wrong plan, and about 9% of us, in other words, about 1 in 10 of us, has a good estate plan. And I've been in the estate planning work now for a good number of years, and I would say this is probably pretty close to accurate, even within our larger church-connected community. Okay, pardon. Just a couple of things to take note of. I notice we don't have a lot of young people here, and I don't blame them necessarily, but the truth is there is a reality that all of us need to come to terms with, and that is the reality of our aging. And here's a quote from a book that I have lying around home. It goes something like this: "The sun at noon is the sun declining. The person born is the person dying." Now, I don't know where this quote comes from. But the truth of the matter is we are all aging, and we need to plan. One more slide here on. This is touching just briefly on the whole thing of the national landscape. This is the world we're in. We do have increased wealth. More than previous generations, we have a lot more wealth. Now, this slide I was put together before the last 6 months and the recent stock market decline, but the data suggests that by the year 2050, as much as $136 trillion will transfer to the next generation. This was a few months ago when $1 trillion was real money, and now we spend it just like we used to spend $1 billion, I guess. But we're also in an environment now where estate taxes are dramatically reduced. Arlen's going to talk a little bit about the change in estate taxes. And that is no longer the big concern that we're facing. And then finally, the biggest factor that can change how we plan for the end of life is the fact that we no longer die at home that we used to in a previous generation. 85% of all deaths are in some kind of a healthcare setting. And that's because, in part, we have so many more options available for extending life, delivering care, and of course, life expectancy has gone on up. This has an impact on the kind of planning we need to do in our estates. And Arlen's going to touch on a couple of those tools. Now, the next phase here is Arlen will talk about some of the basic tools that all of us need, and then Kevin will take it from there.
If it's okay. What are the big obstacles to estate planning? One of the reasons why, what were the figures? Something like 70% of people in the U.S. don't have an estate plan, and another 20% probably have the wrong plan. Is it may not be all that pleasant to think about. The first step is to simply give some thought to whether you have an estate plan. Is that estate plan up to date? And is that something that you need to address? The obstacles include a fear of dying. People don't really like to think about their mortality, about the fact that we all will die at some point. Sometimes people assume that if they don't really have much money or a lot of property, that an estate plan is unnecessary. Sometimes there are family issues. There's uncertainty about how other family members will respond, or sometimes difficulty in thinking about how you'll address some of the complex issues when there are relationship problems or when there are concerns about how a family member might use resources, some of those kinds of things. And depending on the size of one's estate, estate planning can become very complex and very, very tough to sort through. Last but certainly not least is the cost of estate planning. And obviously that's something that, again, varies a lot depending on the needs of the person, but is something to think about. What are the benefits of estate planning? One of the most important roles that a person can play, and one of the biggest favors that a parent can give to their children, is to set up the lines, the barriers, the fences, if you will, that will control the division of assets. I'm sure many of us are familiar with the kinds of stories of where families had disputes about how things would get handled. Sometimes parents thought they were taking care of those things, and the plan just wasn't appropriate to the situation. Other times, people just didn't get to it, and then the children and the family have a very difficult time sorting through the issues. Obviously, it's a tremendous benefit and a tremendous gift for a parent to take care of those issues so that their children aren't put in the position of potentially having disputes with each other about what mom wanted or what dad wanted. Another important benefit is the possibility of providing sustenance to the kinds of charities, church work, etc., that we find important. There's no better way to leave a legacy that represents what you believe in than to do planning that benefits the church organizations that you want to have benefited. Sometimes there can be issues around minimizing the expense of probate, depending on what approaches are taken. There are almost always tools that can be used to minimize the cost of probate. For some of us, a decreasing number in the last number of years, there's the possibility of saving on estate taxes. And of course, there's the satisfaction of just having your assets in order, your life in order, having the sense that things are being done properly. Estate taxes are not the big issue that they once were. Now, this graph gives you an indication of some of the changes in the federal estate tax over the last number of years. You'll notice that since we are in 2009, if you have an estate that is worth $3.5 million or more, you are subject to federal estate tax. If you manage to survive until next year, there is a one-year repeal of estate taxes, and then you see the following year it jumps way down to $1 million. I think the consensus among those who follow this situation is that due to the federal budget issues and just the current political configuration, the law will change in all likelihood within the next year, and in all likelihood there'll be a federal threshold in the range of $3 to $5 million. We can do some planning. As estate planners, we can help people plan to some degree regardless of where that threshold is. The other thing that I would just point out is that even if you are not subject to federal estate tax, there is a minimal, it's a rather insubstantial, but there is some Kansas estate tax that kicks in at about $1 million this year. Again, that's something that may well change in the near future because of the budget issues that the governments are facing. So how does the estate planning process work? What are the steps to take? The first is to think about what your goals are. Think about what you want to do with your estate planning. Do you have a spouse that you're concerned about? Do you have children that you're needing to give some thought to caring for? What about the charities that you want to benefit? The second step is to evaluate your situation. Look at your assets. Give some thought to how those are currently titled, who owns them and in what form, and that matters a lot when you're doing estate planning because, for instance, if you have a if your house is in joint tenancy between a husband and a wife, as most people's are, that's something that needs to be taken into account when it comes to doing your estate planning. Of course, you want to think about who you want to benefit, whether that's your children, your church, other charities, any other beneficiaries that you have in mind. And of course, one of the first steps is to figure out what it is you have in terms of what is the value of your assets. The next step is to develop a plan. That's something that most of us are not really prepared to do on our own. Most of us will need the help of at least one or a couple of professionals in putting together a plan that deals with our estate planning issues. Those professionals, of course, are financial planners. Often a person will benefit from talking to an estate planning attorney. And with the help of those people, a plan can be put together. The fourth step is to put that plan into action, make whatever changes need to be done, put together the documents that effectuate the estate plan you want to have for your family. And then the fifth step is to simply pay attention to what's happening around you, monitor your assets, things that are happening to your beneficiaries, what's happening in your family, what's happening in terms of tax levels, etc. And, of course, pay attention to those things and talk to your professionals as you need to. So there we see the five steps. I'm going to talk a little bit about the basic four tools of estate planning. The will, the financial durable power of attorney, which is often referred to as a durable general power of attorney, a living will, and the durable power of attorney for health care. A will, of course, is a legal document. It generally is used for a couple of really important matters. For some of us, especially if we're younger and we don't have a lot of assets, probably the most important tool that the will serves for us is to help make plans for how our children will be cared for in the event that something happens to the parents of the children. Obviously, another critical purpose of the will is to determine what happens to any assets that we have. And of course, you designate the person who has the responsibility of fulfilling these jobs of seeing that the children are taken care of and the assets are taken care of. In the will, you designate those people who will have that responsibility after you're gone. The second tool is the financial durable power of attorney. That's a tool that basically allows you to designate a person to make financial decisions for you when you're not able to. Now, usually we think about that in the context of maybe an elderly person who over time is losing either the capacity or just simply the interest in managing their financial affairs. But it's also a tool that has broader uses than that. I, not long ago, had the opportunity to prepare a durable power of attorney for a young man who was going to the mission field, and he simply needed to give his father the authority to take care of some financial matters for him while he was gone. The living will is an important tool allowing us to give guidance in advance for a time when we're not able to, when we have serious medical issues and perhaps maybe in our last days or moments before death. This can be a very important tool for Christians who are concerned about stewardship issues around the end of life, and for Christians who have the sense that it really is not our ultimate goal to stretch out life for every possible second, but that there is a time when it is time to let go and not to try to push back death beyond its appropriate time. The fourth tool is the durable power of attorney for healthcare, and it's similar to the power of attorney for financial decisions, only this is a tool that allows the person you've designated to make medical decisions for you. And obviously what you're usually dealing with there is when a person is so sick that they are not able to make those decisions, then there's somebody who can step forward and talk to doctors and have access to medical information and so forth, and help the family and the doctors make important decisions. When we talk about the will as an estate planning device, there are some other alternatives that are often used for estate planning that serve at least a corollary purpose, if not serving as a replacement. A trust can often serve in that role. Trusts can be used for a lot of different things, not just for an estate planning device. For instance, there are often trusts that are set up for special needs people who need resources, but where parents need to maximize the resources that are available for their child who has special needs, but they also want to be able to contribute to their well-being through the benefit of financial planning. They can serve a very important role in that way. A trust is often a very helpful tool when there are concerns about how property might be used by a child who simply doesn't have the capacity to handle finances. And of course, as many of you are aware, trusts are often used to reduce the inconvenience and the cost of probate. It's important to be aware of how ownership of property can affect your estate planning. Any type of life insurance property is typically not disposed of in an estate plan because the money that flows from a life insurance policy typically will not be a part of the estate unless the policy has been designed in such a way as to flow to the estate. I previously touched on the issue of joint ownership. Often that's a very good way to handle ownership because if something happens to the husband, the wife will simply take over ownership and it's completely seamless. But there can be times when that really does not work very well. One of the situations that we're seeing more frequently because people are simply living longer is where you have a situation where maybe somebody's spouse has passed away and they have remarried. And then there are often issues that need to be addressed about ownership of property and so forth. That can be done through appropriate estate planning. Often that can be done through what's called antenuptial planning, where the parties to a second marriage make plans ahead of time before the marriage about what happens to their individual property and so forth. An important part of estate planning is to take into account what insurance you have in place and whether or not there are insurance needs that have not been met. And that's something that you can often work out with your financial planner or your insurance representative. Charity, obviously, is something that is often done through the will or through other testamentary means. And, of course, there are a lot of different options in terms of charitable institutions. And I think Kevin and Mike will probably have more to say about some of these things. One of the most important things when you're putting together an estate plan is to be in communication with your family, and in particular with your heirs. Often there can be uncertainty around an estate plan and what was intended. And one of the best ways to combat that is to make sure that everybody understands what's going on. You've talked to the kids about, you know, how everything's being arranged. Often there can be very valuable feedback that can come from heirs where parents find out that, you know, this really is not something that a child sees as helpful. Maybe another way of working with the assets is a way that is more beneficial to the entire family. And finally, a letter of instruction can be extremely helpful, whether that's part of the estate planning itself through the will or through the trust, or whether that's a separate letter of instruction that points the direction where documents can be found, what financial assets are out there and how those can be found, and people that need to be spoken to, such as one's accountant, one's attorney, etc. I just recently dealt with a situation where a gentleman had assured some of his close friends, he had no family, he had assured his close friends that he had taken care of all that stuff, meaning his estate plan and so forth. His friends came to me just within the last month. The man had passed away. They have no idea where his will is. They can't find any of his important documents. They don't know if they even have all of his bank accounts. It's a remarkably difficult situation. You can do your heirs a big favor by laying a lot of things out for them in advance. Again, the five steps: set your goals, evaluate your situation, develop a plan, implement that plan with documents, and then monitor and adjust. We've talked about all these different tools and strategies. I'm not going to reiterate those. And that's it.
I don't have the fancy technology, so we'll have to do it a little differently. Mike said we were going to talk a little bit about some of the different tools that we have that are related to estate planning, and you can see it somewhat sometimes can be complex and get a little overburdensome, but it's really not that tough. It's just a little different language, and working with Arlen, with Mike, myself, it's something that's easy to work through. A couple of the tools that we utilize are the IRS, in its benevolent nature, decided to exempt a few items from income tax when assets were passed. I didn't hear any chuckles, so maybe you are sleeping. I was just wondering. One of those is life insurance. It can be used for a couple of different things. One of it can be for income replacement, or it can be used for asset or wealth transfer. And you think, well, okay, why would I want to do that? Well, if you have accumulated some money in an IRA or a 401k, a SEP, or a simple retirement plan, when you take that money out, it becomes income taxable. If you have set up your financial plan and your estate plan appropriately upon your death, you may not want that to go to your spouse. You might say, you know what, let's give that money to charity because a charity pays no income tax. And let's replace that asset was something we would have paid about an equal amount on what the income tax would have been with an asset wealth transfer policy, a life insurance policy that's federal income and state income tax free. And that goes back to what David talked about earlier is, you know, how do we utilize our talents? We need to give to Caesar what is Caesar's, We need to give to the IRS what is the IRS's. But if they give us an option not to do that, let's take a look and see if there is some advantage to make some sense to do that. One of the things that we see in our world, we see a lot of, Mike alluded to this, we spend $1 trillion a week like it's nothing in the federal government. We see a lot of greed. And one of the things that's appropriate is when we take a look at what, you know, do we need life insurance? Number one, is it appropriate for us? And if so, what amount? We want an appropriate amount. You don't want to be exceeding in that amount, but you don't want to also be under. You don't want to have a surviving spouse to have to change a financial lifestyle due to a death significantly. You don't want to see him go up in wealth. You don't want to see him go down. We have a tool, and I have some of those brochures back there on the table. Just MMA, how much do your survivors need? And this is also a tool as you do estate planning. You may not have a need for income replacement. Tool to take a look at saying, how can I benefit a charity? I haven't been able to give them sums of money during my life. I've needed those dollars to live on in the future. Need to keep them a little close to the vest to protect our lifestyle, pay our bills. But upon our death, is there a way that I can maximize what I transfer to a charity, whether it be to a church, whether it be to a mission agency, to a school, so forth? The second tool is long-term care insurance, and Arlen talked about that just briefly. But if we take a look at that, the state of Kansas has done something that I think is really good. Now, we all sitting here tonight are saying we're not going to go to the nursing home, but we probably invariably have at least one family member in our extended family that is residing in a nursing home or in a facility or needing some kind of home care. Long-term care insurance just basically says people pool their money together and say, if you do need home care, if you do need adult daycare, if you need custodial care of some kind, whether it be in an assisted living facility or a full care facility, we'll help share that burden with you and help minimize your estate. Because as you know, if you go into a nursing home, I think the average number is, around $160 per day on a long-term care stay. If you multiply that out times $365, that comes into a big sum of money. The state of Kansas has put together what's called the partnership plan, and if a person has a long-term care insurance policy that pays up to a certain dollar amount, the state of Kansas says, you know, we're going to set aside and exempt that amount of money off of your assets, and if you spend down all your assets, run out of that long-term care policy, whatever you've run out, we're going to protect. You won't have to go on to Medicaid on your other assets. That frees up those assets that you still have. You've done a good job with protection. You've taken some preventative medicine. You've done a good job protecting your estate, and that allows you to contribute that money, either continue it on to the family, pass it on to heirs, have charitable intent with it. And I won't get into great detail on it, but insurance commissioner has put together an excellent brochure explaining that a little bit more in detail. And again, I have that back on the table. Those two tools together are something that may be appropriate for some of us, may not be appropriate for everybody, but I encourage you to come and give us a holler at our office and just say, hey, does this make sense? Is this something that would be beneficial to us as we take a look at moving forward, working with our estate plan, putting together, do we need a will, do we need a trust, how does this all fit together? Because that's one of the ways we do need to give to Caesar what is Caesar's, but if we have a choice, I think most of us would like to direct those dollars a little different direction. Just going to mention here so Mike doesn't forget, one thing we also have, MMA has, is a will preparation benefit under our sharing funds. It's if you, in your household, create a will, update a will, create a trust, amend your trust, MMA will pay $50 to you to help you do that, the cost of that, every 5 years. The caveat is you have to have an MMA product, a Mennonite Financial Credit Union product, and I have a list of all of those. There's quite a few different ones that people have. But again, that's just a little benefit. MMA believes that is something we don't do enough of. You might say, and Arlen mentioned this, us young people, well, we really don't have a lot of stuff. Well, who's going to take care of the kids? Who's going to raise your children? Who's, you know, in a family, we've seen some family members have actual fights between the husband's family and the wife's family in the event of a dual common death. And they get along good at the wedding time, but a number of years later, there are issues. So this is something that's important to take a look at. Questions now? do you have any questions? I've rambled for a while. Mike and Arlen have been very articulate, but are there any questions, anything specific for any of the three of us? What happens when you don't have a will, Arlen?
Well, there is a, everybody's got an estate plan. If you haven't put one together for you, the state of Kansas has put one together for you. And there are guidelines set out by statute. The way that the state does that is they have, in their infinite wisdom, guessed at how most people would want to distribute their assets. And actually, I sort of made a joke out of that, but I actually think that it probably does reflect where a lot of people's priorities would be, which is to start with a spouse and then to, and also to children, and then moves on from there. Obviously, they don't know who you would want to have care for your minor children if you have those. They don't know what charities you're interested in. And of course, you guarantee that, that your assets will go through the probate process if you make no other plans, but under the state's plan, typically the spouse and the children are the beneficiaries, and then there are sort of degrees of further away from that if you don't have a spouse or children in terms of your extended family. Sure, probate is just a process whereby a court supervises the distribution of the assets of a person who passes away with assets. That process is in place to make sure that people don't, that assets of people who have passed away don't get stolen, taken away from, you know, the rightful heirs, etc. Of course, every time you try to sort of guarantee that something happens the way that it should, there are costs associated with that. And of course, many of you are aware that there often are significant costs to going through the probate process. But it is essentially designed to have a judge look at how assets get distributed and say, yes, this is what the person had in mind, and this is the appropriate distribution of those assets. You know, there's not really a set figure. I generally suggest when somebody does estate planning that they at least make the effort to go back within about 5 years and look at the documents that they have prepared and see if they are still, if they still say what they want them to say. Obviously, if there are significant changes in tax law or in other things that might affect you, or if your assets dramatically change, or if a family situation dramatically changes, somebody passes away, or there are grandchildren that people want to benefit, or there are very specific priorities that somebody has, those would all be sort of triggers to suggest, okay, let's look at this again. There's one rule. The court tries to determine what is in the best interests of the children. That if there isn't guidance from the parents, that would seem to me to be a fairly risky way to determine who cares for your children. As Kevin mentioned, it's often the case that both sides of a family feel like they're in the best position to care for the children. And so it's really sort of up to parents to, if they want to exercise their views on that they have a properly executed document. I might just add too, and I don't know if that doesn't answer your question, I hope you follow up.
It does. One question I have is that how much do the rest of the family have to say to it? And you answered that partly by...
They will have input.
Yeah.
Obviously, where it gets and if everybody in a family agrees, you know, they should be here, a judge isn't going to go against that. But obviously, families may not always agree, and there may be, you know, two different sides of a family, and one side might be in another state, and you know, it can get it can be complicated.
I think maybe we're running dry on questions here. I'd just like to point out there's some reading materials available at the back, and they are available for sale. Or if you want to take an order for them, you can also order them, and we can send them to you. And I know a lot of you are familiar with the resources that we have. So let us know if we can help, and we'll stick around and visit some more. David, I think we'll turn it back to you.
Unless there's other questions someone would have. Yes, Julian.
I think I would say that in my own mind, I would probably start thinking that a trust may be in order at any point where transfers will be quite complicated. I hesitate to throw out a number, but if I were to throw one out, I might throw out about $500,000. I can tell you the practice it varies greatly. So somebody else might have a very different figure than that. And I wouldn't say that they're wrong, but to me that might be a point where I would start looking at that. Mike just pointed out that one of the things that can be very much of a complicating factor is if there are assets in multiple states. That can also become incredibly difficult if you don't have a trust in place to handle those things. It expedites it so much when you do have a trust in place that is the owner of those properties in those multiple states. I'm sorry? It minimizes the exposure to probate. Some of the advantages there are that you don't have to wait for the probate process to unfold, and it can unfold at a very slow rate. There are other factors, Julian, you know, that you take into account other than just simply the amount of assets. And one of those would be, for instance, if you need to be able to make transfers of property without waiting for a process that at minimum can be 6 months long and more typically might be close to a year long. When a trust is in place, those assets can be transferred, you know, day one instead of waiting for that process to unfold in its own good time. You're right, Perry, the probate process is sort of short-circuited. Often there are a few documents that will still go through the probate process, but you have the advantage of a lot of the assets not needing to be tied up through the probate process.
Well, thanks to each one of you for having come. And I do, as hard as we worked at getting this meeting scheduled, I wish we would have had a few more people here than we did. But I do thank each of you who did come this evening. If there aren't any other questions, would you like announcements, Harold, yet?
If you would, please.
Yes. What announcements would you have?